1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, probando.
No.
¿Ese es inglés?
Right. Welcome, everybody. This is the ESAC public session where the Security and Stability Advisory Committee presents the work that it has done over the past few months. We are, I am frankly pleasantly surprised that we have as many people in the room as we do. Would normally have a second screen showing the transcript of the speaker's remarks, but we're going through some growing pains in understanding how to use the new system of meeting planning that we're using. So we'll straighten that out, I think, next time. So with that, let me go forward. I'm Steve Crocker. I chair the Security Stability Advisory Committee. We'll have presentations this morning, first by myself, Dave Piscitello, Ram Mohan on my right, and I'll also mention Jim Galvin has had a very substantial hand in putting the pieces of this together. Let me look around the room for a minute and see. There are a handful of ESAC members. Who is here? I see Jeremy Hitchcock over here, and Patrick Vanderwall, and let's see, Greg Rattray, and we have Barbara Roseman from the ICANN staff, and who have I left off? Okay. So I'll be very brief in my usual introductory remarks. We're an external group of security experts chartered by the ICANN board. We give independent advice to the board, to the staff, to other parts of ICANN, the supporting organizations and advisory committees, and to the community at large. We are, as our title says, an advisory committee. We don't have any authority. We don't make any rules. And that's a good thing in the sense that it's important to have checks and balances in any system, and the strength of what we do is dependent upon whether other people choose to pay attention to it. I'll also note that there's an external review of our committee in progress. That is part of the standard cycle of reviews that are mandated by the ICANN bylaws. Every component of ICANN is subjected to this process. We're in the middle of the pack. If there's a whole long list of the reviews, some of which have been, are essentially complete, and others which have not yet been formulated. The external reviewers have written their report, done their external review, written their report, and will be presenting it Thursday morning. And I invite everyone who is interested to come and listen to them. And then begins, I believe, a couple of month period of public comments and reactions. There is a board working group that then digests all of this and then makes recommendations about what to do. I think that's the broad brush picture of the way that process works. Dennis Jennings is shaking his head yes, that I've got it right, and I appreciate that. In the period since the last meeting, we have written 2.9 reports, released SAC 38 on registrar abuse contacts, and SAC 36, excuse me, on comments on the draft ICANN strategic plan. We are on the cusp of releasing a report on who is usage and display, and we will say something about it, but we're still hammering out some fine points about what posture we're taking on some issues, and there's some diversity of opinion within the committee that we want to try to get nailed down properly. So here's what we're now through the introduction, and I will move into short reports. Well, almost. I mentioned the external review of ESSAC on Thursday. It's Thursday morning at this very hour in, I guess, the adjacent room. Must be over by one, Don Diego 2. And on Wednesday, there will be an extended session. I don't know if we'll run the full 3.5 hours, but we have a double session reserved from 9 to 12:30 on DNSSEC, and a considerable amount of interesting and important stuff to cover. It's been a very active period. Okay, so let me cover a series of short items here on things that are in progress or bear only a few minutes. We've been doing a study, and we're not yet done with it, on protecting high-value domains. The stimulus for this study was multiple incidents involving weaknesses at registrars. That is, there were hijackings or comparable kinds of problems with visible, well-known names that were either where the problems were not solely due to the way that the registrant, that is the domain holder, conducted themselves, but were either wholly or substantially complicated by the processes and procedures at the registrars. And so that, it isn't just a question of pointing fingers in particular instances, but of looking at this as a system experience and saying, is there a pattern here, and are there opportunities to provide stronger degrees of protection, particularly for where it would be, where the loss is large, where the value is high, and where those registrants might seek a different level of protection in dealing with registrars. This is a work in progress. We would have liked to have gotten it done, and we expect to have it out shortly. An entirely different activity is looking at what the potential issues are as the root becomes larger, partly due to the introduction of new concepts like IDNs, IPv6, and DNSSEC, and substantially with if it grows large, and particularly if it grows very large due to the introduction of new top-level domains. This is work that we had begun to start and then was overtaken by a formal request from the ICANN board to both the root system, root server system advisory committee and our committee to, in combination with ICANN staff, to study the effects of growing the root. This will be a much more formal study where we will have external support. It's in the process of being organized. We have now formulated a steering committee composed of representatives from each of these three groups, and this work is just starting up, and I am reluctant. What's in the minutes of the board asks for a response by the middle of May. I fired back a very quick response saying, we hear you, but we'll have to see where we are before we can commit to anything. So everything is still in the state of being organized. Greg, do you want to say anything about that? I don't think. There's Suzanne. Hi, Suzanne. You sneaked in. Yes, Suzanne Wolf, who is. Longtime member of ESSAC, but also a key member of RSAC, liaison to the board from RSAC, and on the steering committee from RSAC. So do you want to say anything in addition to what I just said about this?
There's not actually a lot to add to what Steve said, except that I think combining the resources of ESSAC and RSAC and having strong staff support also is going to make this really able to do what the board is going to need to do. It does require a serious resource commitment, and I think we're getting that.
Thank you. A few months ago, the board released a draft of its strategic plan for the for all of ICANN going forward for the next few years. It's part of its regular cycle. We reviewed the strategic plan, particularly from our perspective of being concerned about security and stability issues, and commented in some detail on various aspects of the plan, and published that as a separate report, as well as sending it, of course, to the board. The main points that we covered are that new GTLDs are coming, and they need to study the impact of scaling and complexity. As I said, that's now been overtaken by a formal request from the board to study this in depth. We looked at the wording in the plan about enhanced, where the plan says ICANN will enhance security, stability, and resiliency of the Internet's unique identifiers, and raised concerns about mission creep and appearance as to whether or not this is a new mission. There was commentary in the plan, or a part of the plan, about the depletion of the IPv4 pool and adoption of IPv6. And we commented that although this is an important area, ICANN has a useful but inherently limited role in this. So there's a question of what is actually intended in the plan versus signing on to, yes, this is important and therefore we have to speak to it kind of activity. There's a section in the plan about improving confidence in GTLD marketplace, and the focus of that section of the plan, it was primarily focused on continuity of operation, what would happen if a registry or a registrar failed entirely. That's, of course, of great importance, but it's not the totality, in our estimation, of what it takes to improve confidence in the marketplace. Protecting registrations is also very important. In striving for excellence in core operations, another component of the plan, we suggested documenting the root update process, including metrics. That may or may not, depending upon how things work out, get folded into the root scaling plan as things are evolving. And under strengthening processes for developing policy, we observed that the policy process is sometimes disconnected from the technical advisory processes, not only ours but others, and that those policy processes sometimes underplay things by not understanding what are possible and sometimes reach too far by trying to do things that are beyond what is technically feasible. So those were our comments on the strategic plan. In a different area, there's been quite a lot of work on fast flux activities. Dave Piscitello has been spending quite a lot of time, particularly in collaboration with both the GNSO Fast Flux Working Group and with outside groups, the Anti-Phishing Working Group, a operational intelligence group, ISOI, the RISG is what, the Registry Internet Safety Group, which is sort of a consortium of registries and registrars and so forth. And all of this is aimed at understanding how fast flux is used for malicious intent purposes, and also, most importantly, how to distinguish it from the activities that might appear to be similar but are in fact intended to improve resiliency or capacity in very high capacity systems. So there's, as I say, a lot of activity underway there. Not much for us to say about that here in this forum. Dave, do you want to say anything more about that? Okay. Okay, that is the end of my short reports, and I will move up to okay, some time ago, we issued a statement about the deployment of DNSSEC, and then I want to back up for just a second and say a slightly broader thing. When ESSEC was formed now 7 years ago, we looked around at what are the kinds of things that we should focus attention on. And we began over our initial period spending quite a lot of time on the deployment of DNS security. After a bit, it became clear that that was a process that was much larger and more complicated than we could handle within the normal meeting cycles and energy levels that we had within ESSAC. And a separate stream of activity was started up on multiple fronts and has operated in the ICANN arena under our aegis, but has had a kind of separate life. And as I mentioned at the beginning, there will be a lengthy session on Wednesday on DNSSEC. So there's been this kind of duality of DNSSEC having a life of its own and yet existing within the ESSAC framework, at least within the ICANN arena. So several months ago, we wanted to sort of make clear what that coupling was and issue a statement from ESSAC commenting on where we thought the overall status of the deployment of DNSSEC was. And we identified seven different areas to comment on. We said some things at the time and said we would say more. And so here is the list of the seven areas, and I will walk through each of these very briefly with what's in the report that we just issued. With respect to protocol completeness, there are indeed multiple interoperable implementations of DNS of the DNSSEC standards. There are several documents that related to the standards. The base documents, RFCs 4033, 34, and 35, and then additional documents on key rollover and hashed authentication for denial of existence. That's the NSEC 3. And there is a fair amount of actual operation listed. There are the top-level domains that have implemented DNSSEC in our operation: Bulgaria, Czech Republic, Sweden, Brazil, Puerto Rico, .museum. .org is coming, not quite here. A .gov just signed. And there is more coming along. So that's all quite good news. There is still some ongoing work how to integrate DNSSEC responses into the end systems by expanding the set of error return values, formal DNSSEC validator API, Trust Anchor repository is still quite an open area. How to transfer from one registrar to another. This is one of the issues that was called out in the RSTEP report issued when PIR asked permission to implement DNSSEC for .org. And some very long-term issues about migrating the larger key sizes or to new algorithms, which are probably not immediate issues, but are being worked on. The second and third topics, key rollover and trust anchor repositories, take care of tier together. And there are a handful of different ways to deal with trust anchor rollovers. The report examines these issues in, there is a report that examines these in some detail. There's further work and needed and still some distance before we have consensus within the community about how to proceed overall. This is not a showstopper in terms of individual zones being signed or individual resolvers being in operation. With respect to implementation and deployment testing, following some surprises that were encountered when Sweden first deployed DNSSEC, there's been a considerable amount of work on testing broadband firewalls and routers, particularly in the small office, home office environment. A funded study done jointly with Nominet and we sponsored looked at a set of 24 different boxes and tested in various ways. The results were, let's say, attention getting in the sense that there were very few boxes that passed cleanly. The boxes that tried to do more work, that acted as proxies themselves instead of passing DNSSEC queries DNS queries asking for signed responses upstream, tended to fare worse because they tried hard but they didn't get it right. There is considerable amount more testing going on. Comcast had a vendor summit about a month ago, and said, "Look, guys, here's what we're seeing, and it would be good for you to upgrade your firmware, upgrade your products, and not have them become part of the problem." More on that is going to emerge for sure. On performance and error analysis, and I want a strong caveat here that these numbers are mine and aren't necessarily 100% common across everybody's experience, but I've chosen numbers here which are relatively conservative. That is, this is not putting a positive spin on the numbers. These are kind of close to worst case. That on name servers, there is a very measurable increase in the memory footprint of the size of the zone. There's also a measurable increase in the size of the packets that are returned. There is no perceptible, you can measure it, but it's down in the few percent, increase in the amount of computation time on the name server. So that's on the name server side. On the resolving side, we don't yet have enough experience to have a crisp set of numbers. There's a handful of numbers all over the place. However, the initial experience does not suggest that there's any large issue. Now, validating resolvers are doing DNS lookups and checking the answers full time. End systems that are doing DNSSEC checking spend a very small fraction of their time on DNS because they're doing other things. So if you're looking at a web page, downloading a web page, doing the display of it and so forth, and in the as part of all that, doing DNS queries, whatever the amount of time being spent on DNS, it's still a very, very small fraction of the total time that the end system is spending. So if there are going to be performance issues, they will be in the two areas that are shown on the screen. Excuse me. With respect to end system application support, there's not yet a tremendous amount of information. There are libraries and add-ins available on a wide variety of systems and more coming. And Microsoft has announced formally support for DNSSEC in its servers and has not yet announced formal support in its client systems, but it's clear that they will have to move down that direction, and I believe they are. And there is comparable in-system developments, but coming along at a slower pace. There's this is awfully hard to read this slide from this distance, I can tell. There's a couple of different deployment scenarios. I think I'll just be, both in the interest of time and because it's very hard to read, I'll just give a very quick summary. The question is, where does the validation take place in the, Can you see that hand moving around there up at validating here? Barely. So here's the end system, here's where the data is coming from, and here's the path along the way back, and here's a validating a recursive resolver in the middle. This is maybe the most common case where the checking will take place, and then you have presumably a trusted path between the end system and the recursive resolver. In another case, the endpoint does validating either in between here or way at its end. We are we're still accumulating experience. I would say the vast majority of validations are going to take place in this sort of main recursive resolver that operates either at an ISP or at the edge of an enterprise on behalf of the clients inside an enterprise. What's the availability of DNSSEC name server platforms? We did a survey. This is really your work, Dave, I believe, with quite a few products. And the basic results are that there is a substantial set of products available and more coming. I think that this puts us in the range that this is not an issue, that there's plenty of choices and that they're maturing very rapidly. So that takes me through the survey of those seven areas that we promised to look at. In summary, I'd say that the main open issues are trust anchor distribution and use, that the broadband firewalls and routers still have some distance to go, and of course, integrating DNSSEC with recursive resolvers is an area. We're accumulating deployment experience. Registrars and recursive resolvers, I think, are where the frontier area is at the moment. We're working with a couple of registrars to get them ready to go for general registration processes and serve as worked examples on how this will be done. And so that's evolving over time. And this set of everything I've just said here is also scheduled as part of the Wednesday morning session. So for the people who are here and also going to DNSSEC session, I apologize that you'll be burdened with this twice. So that's the end of this presentation. Any questions or comments that people want to raise? Great. So the next is the who is. You're going to take this? Oh, a question. Red one holds and the blue one you have to hold it.
Okay. So the question from the room, if I get this right, please, is this is a question about the registrar stuff. What are the technical requirements for registrar implementations? Are there any documents on this?
It's a good question. There should be more documents than there are. There is a specification for passing DNSSEC records via EPP, I believe, and there is probably not enough of the right kind of documentation elsewhere, and I will take that question as a strong hint that we better have a better answer next time. Jim?
Yeah, the only additional closing comment is basically an idiot's guide would be ideal.
Idiot's guides are always ideal. Okay, so we need DNSSEC for registrars and dummies or something like this. All right. Dave, your turn.
Good morning. I'm going to talk today about a report that ESSAC released over the weekend on registrar abuse contacts. And as an introduction to the issue, and again, apologies for the dimness of the screen and for the, you know, for the poor resolution. In a typical phishing domain takedown or other illegal or abusive domain takedown, there are basically three chunks of a timeline. The first chunk involves really the precursor to the attack by the phisher, where the phisher registers a domain, creates a phish site, sends a phish email, and now he's got the lures to the illegal website that he's hosted. Out in the wild, people are receiving it. And at that particular point, in many cases, you know, from the first delivery of phish emails, we have anti-phishing service providers, other interveners, brand owners, detecting the phish URL, identifying it, and beginning the process of trying to suspend the site and take down the domain. At this point, we're in the second phase, which is hours 1 through 12. Consumers are receiving email. They are unwittingly being duped into visiting sites, and the process of scam and fraud, impersonation, and other abuses begins. So the clock is ticking, and people are losing money or being, you know, harmed in other ways. At this point, the anti-phishing service providers or interveners are attempting to contact ISPs, registrars, and site owners to try to, you know, take out the site. And the question that we're trying to address today is, how do interveners know whom to contact in this process at this particular time? The important party here with respect to the domain name is the sponsoring registrar. Interveners and law enforcement agents and others can identify the sponsoring registrar through information that they can get from WHOIS. One of the issues that, you know, arises is that now that I know who the sponsoring registrar is, where do I find contact information for the sponsoring registrar? And is the contact information that I can find one that will lead me to someone who can handle abuse claims or criminal complaints? So, how you find registrar contact information depends on, you know, your expertise and your flexibility or agility in, you know, in dealing with these matters. You can visit the registrar's website, and in some cases you will find information there. You can visit ICANN's published list of registrar contacts at the URL cited here. Often you'll ask a colleague, you'll ask a mailing list. You'll ask anyone that you think that you, you know, that you believe might know. You'll ask an ICANN employee. You know. The issue here is very simple. Each failure to locate a registrar abuse point of contact extends the duration of the attack. If you do get contact information, it is not necessarily the case that you're done doing your search. Registrars publish contact information from many points of contact. They publish it voluntarily. Certain published points of contact are not going to be the kinds of people that can handle an abuse claim or a criminal complaint. Some contact information isn't available, and some points of contact aren't available 24/7 to handle an abuse, and criminals don't necessarily take the afternoon off. In many cases, the party that you can reach with an abuse point of contact that is published at a registrar site or available at ICANN's list is a general contact point, and they may not be able to process an abuse claim or to escalate the complaint to a party who can. So the issue that I mentioned earlier is revisited. Each successive failure to locate a registrar abuse point of contact extends the duration of the attack. So the question that ESSAC asks in SAC 038, which was published, I believe, Friday, is that the ideal response times for phishing attacks are measured in hours. Delays introduced while attempting to contact a registrar, and even once contacting the registrar, finding the right point of contact in the registrar to handle an abuse complaint, are measured in hours. So how can we reduce the delay? The document's relatively short, and our recommendations are relatively, you know, focused. We do believe that every registrar should provide an abuse point of contact. Not just an email, not just a phone, but a party that can be effective and responsive in dealing with the complaint. The contact party also should provide complainants with some well-defined and audible way to track the abuse complaint. So it's not a case of sending in an email and having no, you know, no feedback after you've sent in an email about abuse to go by, but have some kind of ticket or some other method to be able to track the progress of responding to that complaint. The information about the abuse contact should be published by registrars. We think it should be listed prominently on the registrar's website, and it should be listed prominently on the ICANN website as a specific abuse contact. We also believe that the abuse contact information should be consistent with other registration contact records, the same richness of information in terms of email, not simply a postal address, but a real honest-to-goodness, a street address, telephone numbers where people will answer phones and the like. It would be very valuable for people who have to deal with some automation to make the contact information available in a machine-readable format. And we believe that it's important that this information be kept accurate, and so we think that it's important for ICANN to periodically check for accuracy, no less than annually. That's pretty much the sum and total of that report. So if there are any questions, I'll take them now.
Good morning. So given the large number of documents published over the weekend, I didn't find time to read this particular one, so I have to rely on the things you said here. One point that's striking me is that we're putting a lot of emphasis on the takedown point. I don't want to debate that here, but I wonder if it is part of a useful balance in this game to actually figure out what the accountability mechanisms are. Do we actually have any kind of reporting about abuse takedowns? Any way to understand whether the abuse takedowns are abused? Any way to detect that if it happens or when it happens? I think that might be a direction of thinking and work that I would really like the folk in ESSEC to spend some brain cycles on.
Yeah, let me make a comment and then turn it back to Dave. I think that's a very sensible and well thought out question. Within the ICANN ambit, we actually, I think, have a very, very limited role in the overall game that's being played out in this process, and that the operational community is the one that's predominantly involved in the takedowns. So that question about how effective it is and all of that is, I think, a very apt and sensible question, but is not one that either we have the data, nor are we in a very good position to go after, and because we have a kind of a supplementary role, if you will, in all of that. The other point that I want to offer, and then I want to ask Dave to step in, is that, and I'll put this in somewhat personal terms, I'm a lot more interested in building systems that are strong in their first place, and although it's absolutely necessary to have operational support to react to problems, my long-term feeling is that that cannot and should not be the totality of the view towards security, that we have to balance that with the much less attractive work of building our houses strongly in the first place rather than just going out and fighting fires all the time. Let me ask Dave to say something then.
I would not portray this document as putting a great deal of emphasis on abuse at the back end. I think it just happens that we've published this before a pending ESSAC document where we are going to talk a great deal about measures that you can improve registration services at the time of registration to not only protect the registrars, but to also reduce the number of opportunities for malicious insertion of domains into the registries. So we look at the spectrum of the issues. I think that it's very important to realize that that we hamstring intervention when they can't contact anyone because there's no published information. And that's an omission that we can identify and fix, and that was the purpose of this document.
It's another tricky problem. I agree that it would be beneficial for certain, because for certain registrars to publish some information so you could contact them. But I fear that the abuse contact will be abused. You know, ENAM works with various private email lists that the bad guys can't post to. So let's say we published an email address that said, hey, if there's ever a phishing, this is where to contact. The bad guys will know that. When they start to phish, they're going to spam that address, or there's going to be other complaints going to that address that have nothing to do with phishing, you know, frivolous complaints. And it gets very difficult to discern which ones are the good ones, which ones are the bad ones, which ones are coming from the bad guys, which ones are coming from who knows who. So I think it's a great ambition to provide contactability to registrars, but I practically speaking, it's a tough problem to solve. If you could solve the abuse of the contact, I'm all in, but I think that's going to be difficult to solve. There needs to be a different channel, I think.
We actually talk about this as one of the issues that the GNSO should consider. We simply didn't throw this out and say, this is the policy. ESSAC doesn't make the policies. We actually recommend in the report that the GNSO consider the potential for the abuse of the abuse contact. I think that the concern you have has merit. I think that there are many ways, including making contact information available to the right parties, as you say. And I think that we have to pay attention to it. I don't think that we can run away from it by saying this is going to be hard.
I agree with that. We shouldn't run away from it. We should help work it out or solve it. But the fact remains that this abuse is going to be, this contact will be abused and it'll end up being useless.
Let me echo Dave's response. I'm sitting here thinking through, what you're saying, and one or two ideas come quickly to mind at how to deal with all of that. And rather than get into an extended discussion here, you and I can go off, and one of us can buy a beer. And the, I'm sure this is a workable problem.
I agree. I think there's a solution. But it's just difficult. You know, we have an emergency contact number. We don't publish it. Not to everyone. It's tough because if we publish it, we're going to have a million people calling it 24/7. And how do we discern which ones are, really, really emergencies and which ones are, are transfer requests or, problems with customer service and hosting and all the other services we offer. So we give our emergency phone number out to, our large resellers, to people who we know provide good complaints, let's say, anti-phishing people. We monitor various private email lists. Those are the methods. We've struggled with this problem ourselves. We'd love to publish our the information so we can get the appropriate contacts, but the appropriate contacts don't contact the abusers contact. They send out a phish, they know that's the abuse thing, they'll spam that like crazy, so you don't get the anti-phish email.
This is a great discussion, and as a measure of it, it's consumed the time that we have. Let me move on to Ram Mohan on who is usage and display. Ram, you're going to run off of my machine, I understand. For you. Okay.
That makes it easy. Good morning, and thank you for being here. I'm here to
present the some ESSAC views on who is usage and display. I realize that we're running a bit short on time, so I'm going to push through the first few slides relatively quickly. So at the very start, what is pretty clear is that registration data is getting more internationalized. All of you know this. And the advent of IDN top-level domains promises to significantly increase both the volume and frequency of registration data being provided in internationalized formats using characters well beyond the US ASCII character set. Local language support affects not only how the data is stored, but also how it is displayed and how what the user experience is all about. Next. The original objectives behind the who is, at least the way we've looked at it, seem to have been that someone registers a domain name, and that registration data and information is stored, in some central repository. Users ask queries on the whois in US ASCII, and the output that comes out on the other side is also in a US ASCII format. But that is evolving to, on the next slide, what you'll see is what seems to be happening is evolving to a place where input can come in one of any sets of languages using character sets well beyond US ASCII, and an expectation that the output is also in character sets beyond US ASCII. And the intent is to have all of this happen without having a Tower of Babel, to ensure that future progress and continuing progress on technology is not halted by confusion of tongues. Go on to the next slide. Now, if you look at standards itself, the RFC 4690 that speaks about next steps in IDN, there's a piece that is highlighted in yellow, and I'll just read it out briefly. The WHOIS protocol itself has no standard capability for handling non-ASCII text. One cannot search consistently for or report either a DNS name or contact information that is not in ASCII characters. So, with that as background, there are some questions to consider. Right now, if you look at how WHOIS information, registration information, and data is considered, the submission and display of contact information is a local matter for registries and registrars. And one of the questions is that desirable? Is that sufficient? And can current practices used by these parties be utilized and exploited to a better extent when contact information itself is not available in US ASCII format? And there's also other questions. For example, what can we actually learn from experience to date? As we know, it's WHOIS and registration data has been available in non-US ASCII modes in many other parts of the world. And there is real experience, and the question is there something that can be learned and leveraged in the GTLD and the new IDN TLD world that we're entering into? And is WHOIS accuracy itself affected? If so, how is it affected? And are there any kind of general principles that the registries and registrars could adopt, any kind of best practices that they could adopt to minimize this Babel effect on WHOIS services? In addition, can we actually deliver a better service that provides better responses to internationalized contact and registration data? We're calling this WHOIS, but just to be clear, and within the ESSAC, we've had some vigorous debate about it. We're not talking solely about the service that is currently running on port 43. There are the ITF has gone forward and put new protocols. IRIS is a well-established RFC that has been out there, yet to be adopted by registries or registrars. The question to consider is, what features will internet users find most beneficial? From a user experience point of view, what kind of features would be most beneficial? And what is actually the right user experience? In the past, there have been statements made that at least one contact, one set of contact data should remain in US ASCII. Is that appropriate? Should it be something else different? We don't actually propose a particular solution on this, but we certainly believe that this is an area that ought to be considered, question that answers ought to be thought about. And I'd already mentioned about IRIS, but there are other protocols, and there's another question, which is, should WHOIS itself, should we say goodbye and start off on something that is new? So we have several recommendations. We would like to suggest that the June 2009 Sydney meeting, we'd like to host a workshop to discuss changes to domain name records usage and display. And we believe that it might be particularly useful because that setting might attract far more people who actually have this problem of having registration contacts that are internationalized. And there are some potential topics for the WHOIS for this workshop as an agenda, but it's certainly not limited to this. The second is a recommendation to the ICANN Board of Directors, which is to direct GNSO, CCNSO, and SSAC to task a working group. And this working group would study the feasibility or suitability of introducing display specifications or standards to address this issue of display of internationalized registration data and to formulate a proposal, as well as to work with the IETF to develop support for non-US ASCII characters for WHOIS type data. I think that brings us to that is the last slide. So that's our recommendations, really two recommendations, on the WHOIS and display area. Open it up for questions. Back to you, Steve.
Thank you very much, Ram. Thank you, Ram. Thank you, Dave and Jim and the entire committee for the work that has been put into this round of reports and studies. I appreciate everybody coming. I'll note for the record that a rough count there have been or approximately 50 people in the room, which is frankly quite surprising to me and an extremely positive turnout from what I would have guessed. We were half expecting to walk into an empty room here. So this is great. So I appreciate everybody's attention and support and encourage vigorous participation and interaction and keep pressing on various issues, whatever comes to mind. Is there any last-minute questions or anything that anybody wants to bring up? I apologize. This time slot is shorter than we usually have. And so we've had to make this a very compressed schedule here. But with that, I will bring this to a close. We have, I think we're in time for the opening welcome ceremony, which is, where is it? It's upstairs, one floor. Thank you. Good morning to everybody.